From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Beauty, politics, inequality, gender, money. They are familiar themes endlessly discussed, but are we hearing every essential voice in those discussions? Rhetorical question, of course, because the answer is obviously no. For example, not enough of us have heard the searing analysis from sociology professor and Black feminist thinker Tressie McMillan Cottom. In her new collection of essays, Cottom says her work is animated by what's still seen as a, quote, radical idea. Black women are rational and human. From that assumption, she says, she works her way analytically through political theory, economics, history, sociology, and culture. She says it rarely fails her. This hour on Point, Tressie McMillan Cottom, a voice of modern Black womanhood. And you can join us. What's your experience of Black womanhood in America? Have you read Tressie McMillan Cottom? And what do you think? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Tressie McMillan Cottom joins us from Richmond, Virginia. She's a professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. She's published frequently in the Washington Post, Slate, The Atlantic, among many others. And much of that work now appears in her debut collection. It's titled Thick and Other Essays. Professor Cottom, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
It's a great pleasure to have you on the program. First of all, can I just ask you about the title of the
sure.
book? Because it's one that grabbed your attention, but I think maybe a lot of people are wondering, thick? Where's she going with this?
Well, if they're wondering where I'm going with that, it says a lot about the reader, first of all. I should tell you that because, right, so young readers, people who spend a lot of time on social media and maybe in popular culture absolutely see it and start laughing. They think it's a bit of an inside joke because it is often used in especially youth culture and African-American culture to mean a certain type of physical presence. And this is where everybody usually starts Googling a picture of me, and I would just really suggest no one do that. But it does usually suggest a presentation of femininity, right, of being somewhere between thin and what we would probably call fat. There's this category out there that we think of as thick. But there's also one of the plays on the title essay is the idea that I also wanted to connect how we move through the world physically as women with Black women's bodies in this world and connect that to our political thought and and the way that we think and approach the world. I have an understanding that Black women, like any other group of people, any other subculture, has a political philosophy and an ideology, and we've got a history of thought. And that history of thought, when I reflected on the things that had been most instructive in my own learning over the course of becoming a girl and a woman in this society, this theme kept resonating with me of nuance, of depth, of complexity in the history of that thinking. And to me, that was just another way to think about thick. And then I wanted to write essays that would expose these different ideas and these different ways of thinking about the world to people who may not experience them themselves. And for that, I drew on this idea of thick ethnography, which comes out of anthropology and sociology, which is this idea that if we get it right, if we accurately represent the nuance of how a culture experiences the world, people who are not a part of that culture can get a window into how people navigate society.
Right. Okay. So I was wondering if you might read a little excerpt from that first essay, from Thick, because it really gives us this powerful sense about what you're exactly talking about. And you bring in your own life experiences as well. So, so from this little excerpt that we've chosen here, can you set it up for us before you read it?
Sure.
Because you talk about Rudines.
Rudines. I was about to say. I may need to pronounce that one for you. Now, it helps tremendously if you're Southern when you say this, Meghna. So I am from North Carolina, and like many communities that have a historically robust Black community, there usually was a street that was known as like a Black Wall Street, right, where African-Americans were usually, because of segregation, lived and worked together and had businesses and sort of a thriving economic center. And Charlotte, North Carolina is no exception. In Charlotte, the heart of our Black Wall Street was a street named Beatty's Ford Road. And that street, although integration has sort of decimated the economic center, it doesn't decimate the cultural center. And so Beatty's Ford still figures very prominently in my experience of growing up Black in Charlotte, North Carolina. And that's where my story begins. On my first of only two visits to Rudine's, I sat alone at the bar waiting for friends as a man sidled up next to me. He talked. I mostly demurred and waited on my croaker plate, fried hard. Just before he asked for my phone number, he said, "Yeah, you know, your hair thick, your nose thick, your lips thick, all of you just thick." It was true, if not artfully stated. Being too much of one thing and not enough of another had been a recurring theme in my life. I was, like many young women, expected to be small so that boys could expand and white girls could shine. When I would not or could not shrink, people made sure that I knew I had erred. I was, like many black children, too much for white teachers and white classrooms and white study groups and white Girl Scout troops and so on. Thick where I should have been thin, more when I should have been less, a high school teacher nicknamed me Miss Personality, and it did not feel like a superlative.
That's Tressie McMillan Cottom reading from her new collection of essays titled Thick and Other Essays. Can you just take us a little bit more into what you're talking about here, Professor Cottom, if you could, about being, like you said, being too much and being, but yet being, seeing that you have to be, or being forced to be less than you are. Tell me more.
It's the duality and the complexity of this idea of being hyper-visible, right? So there's this sense that because you are physically different when you are attending integrated schools, as I did in Charlotte, North Carolina, and like many students of that generation did, as the black student in an integrated school, you were visible, particularly if you were academically gifted or, you know, or high-achieving student, as I was and many of my friends were there in Charlotte, North Carolina, and because people wanted to invest in the idea of high-achieving black students, or they want to invest in the idea of the poor, damaged students that need a lot of attention. And while the motivation there may start from a good place, not always, but may start from a good place, what that does is create this sense of no matter what you do, you're constantly seen by authority figures, and whether that be white teachers or by white students who often have a greater sense of ownership of the school than you do. And while they may always see you, that's the visibility part, the hyper-visibility part says they don't always get to know you. Mm-hmm. And so while you may constantly be seen, right, navigating the hallways and you may be picked out by students and teachers, there's not usually an effort to get to know your perspective on the world, to understand what we might call to be culturally responsive to how people approach the world differently. And the hyper-visibility means that you both can't hide, but also never feel completely seen by authority figures and by your peer groups. And trapped in that space of hypervisibility, I think, is where we wrestle with the ideas of what part of me matters, which all young people are grappling with. But I think that when you are a black woman, it comes with particular risks.
There's also another recurring theme in this first essay that I'd love for you to talk to with us about, and because you mentioned it repeatedly, about fixing your feet.
Yes. So fixing your feet is this metaphor that draws on a very real part of my life, which is I grew up with what people might today call being bow-legged and pigeon-toed. So actually, and I'm actually nursing a hurt foot today, I should tell you, and I had to go to the orthopedic surgeon yesterday who looks at me and, you know, is dismayed and says, "Do you realize how flat your feet are?" And I go, "Yes, I promise you, someone has made me aware of this at some point in my life." You know, there's a lot of conversation when I was growing up about how normally I would walk, if I would need prosthetics. If anybody remembers the scene from Forrest Gump, I was Forrest Gump pre-braces. And so part of this was this narrative of my mother knowing that I had this issue when I was very young and being told by medical professionals that they really should do a pretty major intervention to fix that for me. But the intervention was expensive and it was painful. And my mother decided that, no, instead of doing that, I would just sort of work to overcome, right, the physical limitation, which by and large I did all of my life. I have corrected myself so that I can walk more normally. What that has done over years, however, is that it's caused me extreme pain. And the metaphor I have there is how often those of us who have to fit in to a perception of ourselves by the dominant society that does not feel authentic to us have to change who we fundamentally are because the cost of overriding ourselves or rewriting ourselves is so high in the case of surgery to fix my very flat feet and bow legs, or in the case of fixing ourselves to be less female, less black, less whatever we are that is deemed unacceptable for dominant society, that we try to fix ourselves because we can't fix the way the world perceives us. And while it may work in the short term, just like straightening my feet has worked for many years, it also cumulatively, I think, negatively impacts us. I think that's why we see things like persistently high rates of high blood pressure and mental health issues in the African-American community that don't seem to be able to be explained by biology alone. What public health people have decided is that there is this sort of great stew of how statistical discrimination sort of gets embodied in us through, whether it's through stress, the stress hormones. Something about our bodies, I think, is responding to the fact that all of our lives we're fixing our feet in a way that ultimately harms us.
Yeah, well, you write in the book, fixing my feet means knowing how badly the outcomes are likely to be for persisting and pursuing, but doing it anyway.
That's right.
You say, I fix myself even when it causes great pain to do so because I know that I cannot fix the way the world sees me.
Mm-hmm.
So we just got about 30 seconds to go here before the first break. I'm just wondering if you find that through writing, is that part of that fixing? Is it a step towards fixing?
It is. You know, it is a complicated reality. The reality is this, and it's not one that I think we as consumers of our culture are very comfortable with, not even myself, which is we don't have a whole lot of control over it. But writing, a creative energy, does help me make sense of it, at least in a way that I think helps me fix my feet in a slightly less painful way.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk a lot more about the other ideas that you engage with in this marvelous collection of essays. It's called Thick and Other Essays, and it's the debut collection from Tressie McMillan Cottom. She is a professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University, widely published in a number of places, The Atlantic, Slate among them. And again, those essays have been collected into this new book called Thick. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Tressie McMillan Cottom. She is a writer, columnist, and professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. She's author of the marvelous new collection of essays. It's called Thick and Other Essays. She's also previously author of the book Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. And by the way, we have an excerpt from Thick at our website, onpointradio.org. Professor Cottom, I want to engage with a bunch of your other essays through the rest of this hour. But I do want to just get to a simple question about the tensions that that black public intellectuals may feel in terms of, and especially black women. Because a lot of what you write about is talking about how the experience of black women ought to be honored and recognized and learned from every day in America, in and of itself, just by fact. But you also write about your own personal story as well. So I'm just wondering, is there a tension there between saying, like, look, listen, because we are experts, but also do you feel obligated to weave your own personal narrative into it? Do you see what I'm getting at?
I do. Yeah, and I think about that tension in many ways. This book is one of the ways that I am practicing or trying to come to live with that tension and trying to figure out, quite frankly, if it can be navigated. I'm not arrogant enough to think that I would be the first person to figure out and to crack that very complicated issue. Or to fix it in my own life anyway. This has been an issue for black women who have been been doing intellectual work for the whole recorded history of our time in Western society, which is that what people tend to want from us, what an audience wants when they want to consume what Black women produce as our intellectual work, is they often want to produce, they want to consume our emotions and our experiences, which is not always the same as respecting our expertise mm-hmm. and our intellectual contribution. Now, that's a problem for women intellectuals writ large, I would like to say, but as I always say to people, it can be a problem for everybody. I just happen to be talking about Black women. because I do think it is particularly acute for Black women, because what you're butting up against are stereotypes about who is allowed to be expert, right? And the farther away you move from our dominant assumptions about who should have expertise, generally speaking, the more you have to prove that you have a legitimate claim to whatever you're speaking on. For Black women, that means we're dealing with racist ideas and stereotypes about whose knowledge is valuable, but we're also dealing with gendered stereotypes about who should be allowed to speak and to lead. We're also dealing with class issues about because African-American women, for all the reasons I would hope many of us know, are less likely to be represented in high-income status groups. We are also dealing with the issues of class. We're more likely to be poor or working class. And our society also doesn't value expertise from those groups of people. And so just layer and layer upon sort of inequalities manifest in this way that says for Black women to be respected as experts on whatever it is we've been trained in, mm-hmm. whatever experiences we bring to a conversation, we almost always first have to present a palatable form of our sob story first. You know, I talk about it in the book as, you know, how angry sometimes my senior Black women colleagues will get when they say you're bleeding instead of thinking, mm. right? You're bleeding on the page. And the problem there, of course, is that sometimes, oftentimes, too often, dominant publications and outlets won't let us think until we have first bled.
Mm. You hear me pause here because what I want to do is actually go back to a personal example mm-hmm. that you write about in the book. And of course, I'm feeling a little awkward about that because we were just talking about relying
on
expertise.
That's a hallmark of reading the book. Feeling uncomfortable, I should just say, is a brand. And that may just be unavoidable.
But you talk about that, you know, that the expertise of Black women is questioned, not just mm-hmm. sort of in the intellectual realm, but even mm-hmm. in the context of their very own individual lives. I mean, because
right.
you talk about this, being seen as incompetent mm-hmm. in terms of something as deeply personal as their own
yes.
bodies.
Correct.
Okay. And what I'm leading to here is where mm-hmm. you write about, Black motherhood mm-hmm. and the terrible rates of maternal mortality that
right.
we see in this country mm-hmm. multiple times higher for Black women than other women. I mean, mm-hmm. and this is something that you, not maternal mortality, but you experience a terrible mm-hmm. thing yourself because you, well, you tell the story. I'll just
yes.
stop talking. Stop talking, Meghna. Let your guests tell the story.
This essay is a wonderful example, though, seriously, of exactly that conflict, which is that I never wanted to tell this story. There is in everybody's life, and I do not think I'm special in this way. My experience is just particular, not exceptional. But in every life, there's, I think, a trauma that potentially changes who you are. And my trauma is a particularly traumatic loss of my child. I had all of the hallmarks necessary to have a fairly typical pregnancy in the wealthiest nation in the world. I was middle class. I was educated. I was married. I was healthy. I had chosen what I say in the book was, you know, a good doctor on the white side of town, mm. which is that rough cultural geography that we often use when we are trying to figure out a good service provider, a good school, whether it be a good school, a good home, or a good job. My doctor's office and my hospital was one where well-heeled white women went. And so I expected to have a fairly typical pregnancy. And instead, I not only didn't have a typical pregnancy, but I realized I'd misunderstood what a typical pregnancy was for a Black woman. In the United States of America, a typical pregnancy for a Black woman is more potentially fraught with emotional and physical negative outcomes than it is for white women. And in fact, our experiences of childbirth and labor in this country are on par with what we might think of as more typical in quote unquote, you know, developing nations. Black women are dying and our children are dying trying to be born in this country in a way that's not true for any other group in the United States of America. And I thought I was an exception, if you want to know the truth. And one of the things I learned was that I couldn't be an exception. It didn't matter how educated I was. It didn't matter that I tried to make all of the right choices. At the moment when the healthcare system needed me to be whatever they assumed a typical black woman should be in my position, they treated me that way until I was as incompetent as they assumed that I was. And that looked like not believing me when I said I was having labor pains. It looked like not being proactive to figure out why my labor was starting so early. It looked like not providing me pain management. And it looked like, in the end, blaming me for not making them treat me better. The last thing the nurse said to me as she was leaving, as I was sitting there having just lost my child, and we just figured out whether or not we were going to have a funeral for her, if she'd been alive long enough to have a funeral, was the question. And the nurse turns to me and says, you know, it's nothing. It's not our fault. There was nothing we could do. You never told us you were in labor.
Ugh.
But that's fairly typical, not because, and that's the devastating part, that this is what we do. And drawing from my particular case, I never wanted to write about it because I don't ever want to trade in trauma in and of itself. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not what I do. But I felt like I couldn't tell the larger story of how we structurally make some people incompetent so that other people can enact competency more in our society without telling why I had come to know it. Because part of how I'd come to know was that it should not have happened, right? It was the exceptional nature of this fact that it should not have happened. But the very pedestrian fact that it does happen every day was how I had come to know it.
Right.
And I wanted to value that as much as I did my intellectual knowledge.
You know, I have to say this is the story. This is why I was falling all over myself just asking you to tell the story. Because, you know, I've been fortunate to have a couple of kids myself, and this really hit me personally, Professor Cottom, because it's one of those moments where you realize, oh my God, the degree of one's own privilege, right? And and because I cannot imagine any person in the medical field that I interacted with during my pregnancies ever turning to me and saying, "Well, you didn't tell us X."
They
would never do that. And I hadn't thought of it. I hadn't thought of it that way until I read what you wrote. And it's just stunning because you're right. If anyone in a medical profession looks at a woman who had just lost their child and say, "You didn't tell us you were in labor," they are telegraphing this presumption.
That's right.
That the responsibility lies with you and that you're not smart enough to know what's even going on for yourself. That's an entire system communicating that. And as you write, it's not just you.
That's right.
This is a de facto experience of so many black women in this country.
And I think what, you know, what's really important to me in that story, I mean, lots is important, obviously. But if I had my choice of what I hope people took from that, it was that you can do everything right in our society, but based on who you are, you can never do everything right enough. What we know empirically from research is that education and income do not protect black women from these experiences like they protect every other group of people. So in our society, if you go to school and you get a good job or you're born to wealth, you do all of those things, you get better health care, better outcomes. That is not true for black women. It's not true for our children. And that says something not about black women, but about the way that we refuse to allow black women access to the same type of mobility that we assume everyone has. And then it becomes invisible, just as you were saying, Magna, it becomes part of the background noise of everybody else's experience. And part of what I'd hope to do was to turn the volume up on the background noise.
Yeah. But, you know, I think one of the great moments of generosity in your writing is that you write about how, okay, beginning with this experience of black women in the, you know, vis-a-vis the medical establishment every day, you also write about how you see that more and more of us are there's one reviewer, I'll quote her, saying that more and more of us are caught in the trap of chasing competence.
Yeah.
Right? So you're sort of generously offering the experience of black women and saying, hey, look, it's not just one group of people.
That's right. That, in fact, if you do not see that the way that Black women are made incompetent does not speak to the ways that you will probably be incompetent in the near future, that you are probably missing the whole point of our shared humanity. Mm-hmm. The reality is whatever the healthcare system did to me, the education system is doing to all of us, and the economic system seems to be coming for all the rest of the people who are left on the table. That sort of – you can never be competent enough to overcome the realities of politics and economics once it has been decided that this process needs to be set in motion, that individuals can't do that, that this – we need something bigger and deeper and broader than that. But it cannot happen if you don't start with the people who have experienced it the most and for the longest.
Right. Well, let's go to some callers here because they've been waiting very patiently to speak with you. I'm speaking with Tressie McMillan Cottom. She's a professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University, widely published writer as well. And many of her essays appear in the marvelous new collection. It's titled Thick and Other Essays. And let's go to the phones. Angela is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Angela, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. And thank you so much for taking my call. Thank you, Professor Cottom. I wanted to discuss the code switching that a lot of, especially African-American female professionals, have to undergo. I live in Baltimore City, and I live in the heart of the city. So and I'm also a licensed social worker. So I encountered, and I would say even in my professional studies before I was licensed, I encountered amongst my peers this, I guess, this dissonance, you know, just not understanding that I'm here in this professional school because I qualified just as you. I had a discussion with one of my classmates, and we were talking about what was going on in Baltimore, and I used the word blight. B as in boy, L-I. And she said to me, this is a Caucasian young girl, and I have to say I'm a non-traditional student. I was, at the time, almost 40. And she looked at me and said, you mean plight, right? And I said, no, I mean blight. And she then looked at the Japanese-American woman who was sitting next to me and said, is that a word? And my other peer looked at her as if she had six eyes and said, duh, yeah. And again, you know, I find myself on a regular basis having to prove my validity, having to prove myself worthy of where I am. Not because I question myself, but because everyone else seems to have a question mark over their head.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that, Angela. I talk about my experience of code switching, as Angela describes, this, you know, constant navigation. One way to think about code switching is any minority group in a majority society is usually tasked with managing the emotions of the majority members of the group. And one of the ways we do that is to be able to switch efficiently and fluently between cultural languages and discourses, right? So, and Black people tend to be particularly good at this, and I like to think that we have developed one of the more robust cultures of code switching that exists. And listen, I love that we have this sort of cultural fluency, but I also wanted to push back, I think, in this text on the tax that that has on people, as Angela really describes there, of this constant navigating of making people comfortable. Because as Angela points out, and as many people, Black women have experienced, there really is not enough code switching that we can do to demonstrate to people who fundamentally do not believe that we have agency or value or intelligences. There's really not enough code switching we can do to make those people okay. Right. So when the person turns to, look who she turns to in that exchange for validation of whether or not the word is a word, right? You don't even discuss it with the person who said it, right? So what do you mean by it, right? There's no follow up about, oh, is that what that word means? Oh, is that what that is? Oh, I've never called it that. You know what we call it where I'm from? That would be a normal sort of exchange. But when you are looking to the others around you who are not the Black women to sort of validate the person as they sit there, there was no code switching that was going to fix that. And that's why I talk about, as much as I enjoy the cultural tradition, one of the things, privileges I'm exercising lately in my life is not code switching. Not because I cannot or I should not, but because I want people to feel more uncomfortable in those moments. It's when people are in that moment suspended and have to reflect on why they're uncomfortable that maybe they'll see their actions, right? Maybe it'll prime them to be more reflexive about why they would turn to someone else to figure out whether or not the Black woman knows the word that she was using.
Mm. Well, we're speaking with Tressie McMillan Cottom. She is a writer, columnist, professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. A lot of her writing has been now put into the new collection. It's called Thick and Other Essays. She explores beauty, money, identity, experiences that define Black womanhood in America. Professor Cottom is also author of the book Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. Professor Cottom, when we come back, I want to ask you about beauty and Black women, okay? So stick with us. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Tressie McMillan Cottom. She is a professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University, widely published writer, columnist as well. And many of her essays now appear in the debut essay collection titled Thick and Other Essays. And Professor Cottom is with us today from Richmond, Virginia. Let's go and take another call here. Let's go to Jude, who's calling from New Orleans. Jude, you're on the air.
Hello, Professor Cottom. Hi. How are you all today?
I'm wonderful, Jude. How are you?
I'm good. So my question is, how have you been received, given the topic that you are bringing up in Richmond, Virginia, the proud ex-capital of the Confederacy?
Isn't it, though?
Yes, it is. I am an ex-resident of that city, and I will say, being a, I guess, nearly a lifelong Southerner, it is a different type of South. And I would say that the way that I was raised in Louisiana is a lot different than how things were there.
Jude, can I just jump in here for a second? For those of us who aren't lifelong Southerners, when you say I'm playing the role for all listeners here, when you say it's a different kind of type of South, what did you mean?
I felt very restricted. I felt like there were like a set of rules that I was not privy to. You know, I think, you know, New Orleans sort of is a place where it's very hospitable to all. And you know, people, you know, you walk down the street, you can ask just about any stranger for directions, and you don't get strange looks. You don't, you know, there just isn't a sort of know your place sort of, you know, attitude. You know, It was very strange. And you know, it was weird to see a place that sort of clung to that Southernness, but had this very boundary, you know, these boundaries drawn. And so here you're sort of almost blowing open these, like, okay, we need to talk about this.
Jude is worried about my health and well-being, and I really appreciate that, Jude. No, I know exactly what you mean. And like Jude, you know, I'm a Southerner. Although in the book, I do admit my lifelong shame. I finally had to out myself. I was actually born in New York.
Unforgivable.
I know. Listen, I had letters, angry letters from people going, your whole thing has been a lie. I was like, I get it. I do. I'm so sorry. But I was raised in the South by deep Southerners, and I very much am a child of the South. And I've lived, you know, all over the country. I actually enjoyed and deliberately lived in California, did Boston for a while, in New York, Chicago. And I come back to the South. And I think Jude would probably understand this. There's nothing quite like being Black and being embedded in the South and understanding this place, whether it is always good for us, there is some value in understanding the U.S. South. And I'm not one who wants to write that off. But to Jude's point, I think that Virginia and Richmond is interesting. It is the still sort of proud home of the former Confederacy in the South. The Civil War is alive here in a way that has never been true for me anywhere else that I have lived in the South. It is still very tangible here. But, you know, this sort of movement of the new South city that's been happening, you know, for the last 30 years or so, Atlanta, Charlotte, North Carolina, places that sort of want to embrace its history while at the same time moving forward. I think there's some momentum for that here in Richmond. It just happened here, I think, later than it has in other large urban areas. But, you know, there's a reason why I ground myself in my work in the South, even when it's complicated as it is here in Richmond, Virginia. I do think that's still a story about the Black American experience that matters, even as we turn our eye to how diverse the Black culture is. And I talk in the book about I never want people to confuse my story of Blackness in the U.S. as the story mm-hmm. of Blackness in the U.S. And so I'm always very clear to sort of ground. That's one thing that biography does for me in these essays is to ground my analysis in who I am so that the reader understands that you can never completely separate those two things.
Well, let's go to another caller, perhaps about this point as well. Carmen is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Carmen, you're on the air.
Hello, and hello, Professor. How are you?
Hello, Carmen. I'm great. Thank you.
I am loving hearing all your stories and all the things that you have to say. I agree 1,000% with you. I think that all women need a voice, especially women of color. My parents came to the United States in the 60s, mm-hmm. and my mother could speak four languages mm-hmm. and had two master's degrees, and everyone thought she was stupid, mm-hmm. you know, when she would call on the phone mm-hmm. because she had an accent.
Right.
So I hear, you know, I can relate to what you're saying about how you have to prove, you seem, mm-hmm. you know, women of color have to prove themselves mm-hmm. over and over. I'm just curious about what you think of the voices of Diamond and Silk.
Oh, my.
have a voice, you know, right. they have a voice. They're out there.
Yeah,
right.
They have something.
So we should just note that Diamond and Silk are they're two African American women. They're very popular on social media for their mm-hmm. For their very enthusiastic support of mm-hmm. President Trump, support right. and commentary for the president. Mm-hmm. What do you think about Diamond and Silk?
I'll be honest. I don't know that I think about them a whole lot, except I will say this. You know, there's an old line in sort of like African-American literature about, you know, Black people are not a monolith. That's the standby answer, which is kind of part of my earlier answer, right, is that you never want to say that there is a singular acceptable experience of being Black in the United States, and that would include our political beliefs and affiliations. There have always been Black conservatives in this country, and there probably always will be. That's because we actually have a lot of conservative impulses in our Black social institutions and Black culture, to the extent that there aren't more Black people who support, you know, GOP candidates like Donald Trump. It is generally because GOP policies and rhetoric tends to be so aggressively, you know, racist in its discourse that, you know, it turns off Black conservative voters. But there still always have been Black voters, including Black women, who are sort of proud conservatives. I would say that I am always in favor of us having more than one Black woman's voice. I'm never arguing for a singular voice. And in fact, a singular voice might be more dangerous than having no voice at all in public discourse. Mm-hmm. And I mean that even if it's my voice. You know, sometimes I have to tell people I'm not lobbying for a job, right? I really love the job that I have. I'm not asking to make me the official voice of Black women, but to say that there is space for there to be more than one type of representation and voice for Black women in our political and popular discourse. And, you know, and just if I'm going to be a good moral person, I have to say that includes Diamond and Silk, as much as that might make me choke just a little.
Well, what do you make then of the criticism that they often receive from, mm-hmm. From perhaps other members of the Black community who say that, I don't want to, that they're somehow, betraying African Americans mm-hmm. by being so vociferously in support of the mm-hmm. president, and particularly in a time where Democrats, for example, mm-hmm. love to say, well, Black women are quote unquote saving mm-hmm. America by voting, right. in large numbers Democratic. Right. I mean, look, this takes us back to what you were saying earlier, that once again, mm-hmm. like Black women are put in this place of representing something right. for other people.
Right. I was just about to say, this yeah. is actually, to me, the risk of those types of truisms, as much as they sometimes are coming from a good place. So this thing about, trust Black women, believe Black women will save us, Black superwomen, Black women here to save the day. This is the risk of those types of narratives. A stereotype that is positive is still a stereotype. What stereotypes do is that they flatten people and experiences. That's the entire point. A stereotype is sort of a mental shortcut to help us understand a group of people based on very limited knowledge. And what I'm arguing is that at this point in our history, we don't have limited knowledge about Black women. There's no need for the stereotype. It's not serving any positive value at this point. And even a positive stereotype like trust all Black women negates the fact that Black women can be wrong. And in fact, there's nothing wrong with being wrong. I do not want Black women to be superhuman. We're already human, and that's super enough.
Mm. Well, let's get back to some of the essays that you have in Thick, in the new collection. There's one in particular I'd like to spend a minute or two talking about, or more than mm-hmm. a minute or two. Uh-huh. It's about Black girlhood, because we've been talking yes. about Black women, but really mm-hmm. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Black girlhood, because mm-hmm. you write about it so powerfully in the essay, Black Girlhood Interrupted. Tell us more about that.
I was thinking about a lot. There was a lot happening, as there always is, but there has been this, slow drip, sort of drumbeat around, sexual violence against Black girls here in popular discourse for the past few years. There was this really wonderful research report that came out a couple years ago that showed how our culture assumes that Black girls are older than they are, and how that makes Black girls very vulnerable to sexual assault and violence. And then there was also the pop culture case of R. Kelly, who's the mm-hmm. R&B singer who has for truly, almost as long as I've been alive. I mean, I have known a story about R. Kelly's interest in children sexually for almost as long as I have been alive. That's how long we've been talking about this. And there was this sort of, slow drumbeat culminating perhaps with a recent documentary that aired on Lifetime about it. And there just seemed to be this thing bubbling up. And I wanted to reflect on how difficult it was for me as a Black woman who, like all girls, maturing into their womanhood, is interested in role models, right? We love stories about ourselves. And I remember growing up and having so few stories about Black girls, right? I had the Babysitter's Club. We had, Sweet Valley High. I had tons of coming-of-age stories for boys. And I started thinking about what were the coming-of-age stories for Black girls? And I realized the easiest way to find a story about a Black girl was to read a biography about a Black woman and to look for the sexual trauma, right? Mm-hmm. That it was in almost every biography of Black womanhood that I had found, that if I wanted a story about a Black girl, I could generally find it if I looked for the sexual trauma in a Black woman's life. And to me, those were all part of the same sort of milieu of how we have created a cultural narrative that does not honor or recognize or even have a language to talk about Black girls as girls, and how vulnerable that makes us to things like sexual predation by celebrities or just by rank and file people.
Right. I mean, you write in this essay that the violence often happens because society deems these girls as disposable.
Correct.
And therefore we're not focusing enough about mm-hmm. how to intervene and help.
Right. We've got narratives. The thing about saying that someone is a girl as opposed to a woman, right, or a child mm-hmm. as opposed to an adult is very powerful. In our society, children are extended special protections, right, and exclusions from expectations, social expectations. We say that children need more care, that they should be provided more social resources. We say that children's lives hold a special value in our society. So when you can survey people and ask them whether or not an 8-year-old black girl is responsible for some sexual act that an adult had with her, and people can say, as they did in one survey, well, at 8 years old, she doesn't really look eight, right? She looked older, right? What we are saying is that we are systematically and categorically excluding black girls from the protection of childhood. And everything that means politically and legally, there are even different legal sanctions for what you can do to a child as opposed to an adult. And we have categorically excluded girls from those protections.
Mm. Well, in the last essay in the book, Girl Six, that's the essay that I quoted from at the very beginning of our conversation. Mm-hmm. I just want to read a paragraph once again that I quoted from. You write, "It is not that all or any black woman is beyond reproach, but that she cannot be reproached merely for being a black woman. It is still a radical idea." And then you say, "It is at the heart of my research. Black women are rational and human. Working from that assumption, I work my way analytically through political theory, economics, history, sociology, and culture. It rarely fails me." Professor Cottam, I wanted to ask you, how do we get past this being a radical idea?
That's a great question. So I do think, I mean, one of the things that I maybe perhaps a bit tongue-in-cheek in that final essay try to critique is how important it is for us to, as a society, and I don't mean us just as black women, for us to perform publicly what it means to engage with black women. That's why I think it matters. It can seem like a really silly thing to say that there are no black women on our op-ed pages of any national newspaper until recently. Michelle Alexander joined the New York Times fairly recently. But that there are no black women at that level of discourse. And I go, well, yeah, but it's a silly job. You know, it doesn't really matter. Well, what I think those types of jobs do is that they do signal to the greater public who we should take seriously, one, right? Who we have to engage with to be participants in public discourse, and to model for people, how do you disagree with a black woman without doing it through negative stereotypes of her? How can we critique the ideas of a black woman political candidate, for example, as it looks like we're now going to have to learn how to do in real time? All right. How do we do that without filtering it through our stereotypes of black women being angry, right? That people need to see that performance of black women as experts, whether they're good experts or infallible experts, but that there's a role for that to happen in public discourse, and we could all use that lesson.
Well, Professor Cottam, will you come back again and speak with us?
Anytime, Magna. Seriously, anytime.
I feel like we're just getting started.
We kind of were.
I mean, there's so much more, and I would love to have you back. So please do come back.
I'm going to take that as an invitation.
Definitely. It's a standing one. Tressie McMillan Cottam is a professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University, widely published in The Atlantic and Slate and others, and many of her essays now appear in the debut collection Thick and Other Essays. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Professor Cottam, thank you so much once again.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.